hours. Risa would like to attack her with a weed whacker. Do you have any questions or concerns, dear? If you do, there's no better time to ask. What happens to the bad parts? The question seems to throw the woman off stride. Excuse me? You know, the bad parts. What do you do with the club feet and the deaf ears? Do you use those in transplants? You don't have either of those, do you? No, but I do have an appendix. What happens to that? Well, says the counselor with near infinite patience, a deaf ear is better than no ear at all. And sometimes it's all people can afford. And as for your appendix, nobody really needs that anyway. Then aren't you breaking the law? Doesn't the law specify that you have to keep 100% of an unwind alive? The smile has begun to fade from the counselor's face. Well, actually it's 99.44%, which takes into account things like the appendix. I see. Our next bit of business is your pre-admission questionnaire. Due to your unorthodox arrival, you never had the opportunity to fill one out. She flips through the pages of the questionnaire. Most of the questions don't matter at this point. But if you have any special skills you'd like to let us know about, you know, things that could be of use to the community during your stay here. Risa wishes she could just get up and leave. Even now, at the end of her life, she still has to face that inevitable question, what good are you? I have some medical experience, Risa tells her flatly. First aid, CPR? The woman smiles apologetically. Well, if there's one thing we have too many of here, it's medical staff. If the woman says well one more time, Risa may just drop her down a nice deep one. Anything else? I helped in the infant nursery back at Steho. Again, that slim smile. Sorry, no babies here. Is that all? Risa sighs. I also studied classical piano. The woman's eyebrows raise about an inch. Really? You play piano? Well, well, well. 53. Connor. Connor wants to fight. He wants to mistreat the staff and disobey every rule, because he knows if he does, it will get this over with faster. But he won't give in to the urge for two reasons. One, it's exactly what they want him to do. And two, Risa. He knows how it will devastate her to see him led to the chop shop. That's what the kids call it, the chop shop, although they never say it in front of the staff. Connor is a celebrity in his dormitory. He finds it absurd and surreal that the kids here see him as some sort of symbol, when all he did was survive. It can't be all true, right? The kid who sleeps in the bed next to his asks the first night. I mean, he didn't really take on an entire squad of juvie cops with their own trank guns. No, it's not true, Connor tells him, but denying it just makes the kid believe it even more. They didn't really shut down entire freeways looking for you, another kid says. It was just one freeway. They didn't shut it down. I did, sort of. So then it's true. It's no use. No amount of downplaying the story can convince the others that the Akron AWOL is not some larger-than-life action figure. And then there's Roland, who, as much as he despises Connor, is now riding Connor's fame wave for all it's worth. Although Roland's in another unit, wild stories are already getting back to Connor about how he and Roland stole a helicopter and liberated 100 unwinds being held in a Tucson hospital. Connor considers telling them that all Roland did was turn them in, but decides life is literally too short to start things up with Roland again. There's one kid Connor speaks to who actually listens and can tell the truth from the fabrications. His name is Dalton. He's 17, but short and stocky, with hair that has a mind of its own. Connor tells him exactly what happened on the day he went AWOL. It's a relief to have someone believe the truth. Dalton, however, has his own perspective on it. Even if that's all that happened, Dalton says, it's still pretty impressive. It's what the rest of us wish we could have done. Connor has to admit that he's right. You're like king of the unwinds here, Dalton tells him. But guys like you get unwound real quick, so watch yourself. Then Dalton takes a long look at him. You scared? He asks. Connor wishes he could tell him different, but he won't lie. Yeah. He seems almost relieved that Connor's scared too. In group, they tell us that the fear will pass and we'll get to a place of acceptance. I've been here almost 6 months, and I'm just as scared as the day I got here. 6 months? I thought everyone goes down in just a few weeks. Dalton leans in close and whispers, as if it's dangerous information. Not if you're in the band. A band? The thought of there being music at a place where lives are silenced doesn't sit well with Connor. They set us up on the roof of the chop shop and have us play while they're bringing kids in, Dalton says. We play everything. Classics, pop, old world rock. I'm the best bass player this place has ever seen. And then he grins. You should come listen to us tomorrow. Just got a new keyboard player. She's hot. Volleyball in the morning. Connor's first official activity. Several staffers in their rainbow of flowered shirts stand on the sidelines with clipboards because apparently the volleyball court isn't equipped with 12 individual cameras. From behind them, on the roof of the chop shop, music plays. Dalton's band. It's their soundtrack for the morning. The opposing team completely deflates when they see Connor, as if his mere presence will ensure their loss. Never mind that Connor stinks at volleyball. To them, the Akron AWOL is a star in every sport. Roland's on the opposing team as well. He doesn't wilt like the others. He just glares, holding the volleyball, ready to serve it down Connor's throat. The game begins. The intensity of play can only be matched by an undercurrent of fear that runs beneath every tap of the ball. Both teams play as if the losers will be immediately unwound. Dalton had told Connor that it doesn't work that way, but losing can't help either. It reminds Connor of the Mayan game of Pakatok, something he learned about in history class. The game was a lot like basketball, except that the losers were sacrificed to the Mayan gods. At the time, Connor thought it was cool. Roland spikes the ball, and it hits one of the staffers in the face. Roland grins before he apologizes, and the man glares at him, making a note on his clipboard. Connor wonders if it will cost Roland a few days. Then suddenly, the game pauses, because everyone's attention begins to shift to a group of kids in white, passing the far side of the court. Those are tithes, a kid tells Connor. You know what those are, right? Connor nods. I know. Look at them. They think they're so much better than everyone else. Connor has already heard how tithes are treated differently than the regular population. Tithes and terribles. That's how the staff refers to the two kinds of unwinds. Tithes don't participate in the same activities as the terribles. They don't wear the same blue and pink uniforms the terribles wear. Their white silk outfits are so bright in the Arizona sun, you have to squint your eyes when you look at them, like they were adolescent versions of God himself. Although to Connor, they look more like a little squad of aliens. The terribles hate the tithes, the way peasants despise royalty. Connor might have once felt the same way, but having known one, he feels more sorry for them than anything else. I hear they know the exact date and time of their unwinding, one kid says. I hear they actually make their own appointment, says another. The ref blows his whistle. All right, back to the game. They turn away from the bright white uniforms of the chosen few and add one more layer of frustration to the match. For a moment, as the tithes disappear over a hillside, Connor thinks that he recognizes a face among them, but he knows it's just his imagination. 54. Lev. It's not Connor's imagination. Levi Jedediah Calder is one of the very special guests of Happy Jack Harvest Camp, and he is wearing his tithing whites once more. He does not see Connor on the volleyball court because the tithes are strictly instructed not to look at the terribles. Why should they? They have been told from birth they are of a different caste and have a higher calling. Lev may still have the remnants of a sunburn, but his hair is cut short and neat, just as it used to be, and his manner is sensitive and mild, at least on the outside. He has an appointment for unwinding in 13 days. 55. Risa. She plays on the roof of the chop shop, and her music carries across the fields to the ears of more than 1,000 souls waiting to go under the knife. The joy of having her fingers on the keys again can only be matched by the horror of knowing what's going on beneath her feet. From her vantage point on the roof, she sees them brought down the maroon flagstone path that all the kids call the red carpet. Kids who walk the red carpet have guards flanking them on either side, with firm grips on their upper arms, firm enough to restrain them, but not enough to bruise them. Yet, in spite of all this, Dalton and the rest of his band play like it doesn't matter at all.
"How can you do this?" she asks during one of their breaks. "How can you watch them day after day going in and never coming out?"
"You get used to it," the drummer tells her, taking a swig of water. "You'll see."
"I won't. I can't."
She thinks about Connor. He doesn't have the same reprieve from unwinding. He doesn't stand a chance.
"I can't be an accomplice to what they're doing."
"Hey," says Dalton, getting annoyed.
"This is survival here. And we do what we have to do to survive. You got chosen because you can play and you're good. Don't throw it away. Either you get used to kids walking down the red carpet, or you'll be on it yourself, and we'll have to play for you."
Risa gets the message, but it doesn't mean she has to like it.
"Is that what happened to your last keyboard player?"
Risa asks. She can tell it's a subject they'd rather not think about. They look at one another. No one wants to take on the question. Then the lead singer answers with a nonchalant toss of her hair, like it doesn't matter.
"Jack was about to turn 18, so they took him a week before his birthday."
"He was not a very happy Jack," says the drummer and hits a rim shot.
"That's it?" says Risa. "They just took him?"
"Business is business," says the lead singer. "They lose a ton of money if one of us turns 18. Because then they've got to let us go." "I've got a plan, though," says Dalton, winking at the others who have obviously heard this before. "When I'm getting close to 18, and they're ready to come for me, I'm jumping right off this roof."
"You're going to kill yourself?"
"I hope not. It's only 2 stories. But I'll sure get busted up real bad. See, they can't unwind you like that. They have to wait until you heal. By then I'll be 18 and they'll be screwed." He high-fives the drummer and they laugh. Risa can only stare in disbelief.
"Personally," says the lead singer, "I'm counting on them lowering the legal age of adulthood to 17. If they do, I'll go to the staffers and counselors and friggin' doctors. I'll spit right in their faces, and they won't be able to do anything but let me walk right out that gate on my own 2 legs.
Then the guitar player, who hasn't said a word all morning, picks up his instrument. "This one's for Jack," he says, and begins playing the opening chords to the pre-war classic, Don't Fear the Reaper. The rest of them join in, playing from the heart, and Risa does her best to keep her eyes away from the red carpet. 56. Connor. The dormitories are divided into units. There are 30 kids per unit. 30 beds in a long, thin room with large, shatterproof windows to bring in the cheerful light of day. As Connor prepares for dinner, he notices that 2 beds in his unit have been stripped, and the kids who slept in them are nowhere to be seen. Everyone notices, but no one talks about it, except one kid who takes one of the bunks because his mattress has broken springs.
"Let a newbie have the broken one," he says. "I'm going to be comfortable my last week."
Connor can't remember either the names or the faces of the missing kids, and that haunts him. The whole day weighs heavily on him, the way the kids think he can somehow save them, when he knows he can't even save himself. The way the staff keeps waiting for him to make a mistake. His one joy is knowing that Risa is safe, at least for now. He had seen her after lunch when he stopped to watch the band. He had been searching for her everywhere. And all that time she was right there in plain view, playing her heart out. She had told him she played piano, but he never gave it much thought. She's amazing, and now he wishes he had taken more time to get to know who she was before she escaped from that bus.
When she saw him, watching that afternoon, she smiled, something she rarely did. But the smile was quickly replaced by a look that registered the reality. She was up there, and he was down here. Connor spends so much time with his thoughts in the dormitory that, when he looks up, he realizes that everyone in the unit has already left for dinner. As he gets up to leave, he sees someone lurking at the door and stops short. It's Roland.
"You're not supposed to be here," Connor says.
"No, I'm not," says Roland.
"But thanks to you, I am."
"That's not what I mean. If you get caught out of your unit, it's a mark against you. They'll unwind you sooner."
"Nice of you to care."
Connor heads for the doorway, but Roland blocks his path. For the first time, Connor notices that in spite of Roland's muscular build, they're not all that different in height. Connor always thought Roland towered over him. He doesn't. Connor prepares himself for whatever Roland might have up his sleeve and says,
"If you're here for a reason, get on with it. Otherwise, step aside so I can get to dinner."
The look on Roland's face is so toxic it could take out an entire unit.
"I could have killed you a dozen times. I should have, because then we wouldn't be here."
"You turned us in at the hospital," Connor reminds him. "If you hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here. We all would have made it safely back to the graveyard."
"What graveyard? There's nothing left. You locked me in that crate and let them all destroy it. I would have stopped it, but you never gave me the chance."
"If you were there, you would have found a way to kill the Admiral yourself. Hell, you would have killed the Goldens if they weren't already dead."
"That's what you are. That's who you are."
Roland suddenly gets very quiet, and Connor knows he's gone too far.
"Well, if I'm a killer, I'm running out of time," says Roland. "I better get to it."
He begins swinging, and Connor is quick to defend. But soon it's more than just defending himself. Connor taps into his own wellspring of fury, and he lets loose a brutal offensive of his own. It's the fight they never had in the warehouse. It's the fight Roland wanted when he had cornered Risa in the bathroom. Both of them fuel their fists with a world's worth of anger. They smash against walls and bedframes, relentlessly pummeling each other. Connor knows this is not like any fight he's ever had before. And although Roland doesn't have a weapon, he doesn't need one. He's his own weapon. As well as Connor fights, Roland is simply stronger. And as Connor's strength begins to fade, Roland grabs him by the throat and slams him against the wall, his hand pressed against Connor's windpipe. Connor struggles, but Roland's grip is way too strong. He slams Connor against the wall over and over, never loosening that grip on his neck.
"You call me a killer, but you're the only criminal here," screams Roland. "I didn't take a hostage. I didn't shoot a juvie cop. And I never killed anyone. Until now."
Then he squeezes his fingers together and shuts off Connor's windpipe completely. Connor's struggles become weaker without oxygen to feed his muscles. His chest heaves against the absence of air, and his vision begins to darken until all he can see is Roland's furious grimace. "Would you rather die or be unwound?" Now he finally knows the answer. Maybe this is what he wanted. Maybe it's why he stood there and taunted Roland. Because he'd rather be killed with a furious hand than dismembered with cool indifference. Connor's eyesight fills with frantic squiggles. The darkness closes in, and his consciousness fails. But only for an instant. Because in a moment, his head hits the ground, startling him conscious again. And when his vision starts to clear, he sees Roland looking down on him. He's just standing there, staring. To Connor's amazement, there are tears in Roland's eyes that he tries to hide behind his anger, but they're still there. Roland looks at the hand that came so close to taking Connor's life. He wasn't able to go through with it, and he seems just as surprised as Connor.
"Consider yourself lucky," Roland says.
Then he leaves without another word. Connor can't tell whether Roland is disappointed or relieved that he's not the killer he thought he was, but Connor suspects it's a little bit of both. 57. Lev. The tithes at Happy Jack are like first-class passengers on the Titanic. There's plush furniture throughout the tithing house. There's a theater, a pool, and the food is better than homemade. Sure, their fate is the same as the Terribles, but at least they're getting there in style. It's after dinner, and Lev is alone in the tithing house workout room. He stands on a treadmill that isn't moving, because he hasn't turned it on. On his feet are thickly padded running shoes. He wears a double pair of socks to cushion his feet even more. However, his feet are not as concerned.